Okay, so I got to Europe. First commune that I went to is this community called Svendholm, which is in Denmark. It's about an hour and a half northwest of Copenhagen. Still accessible by public transportation, largely. But certainly in the country. There's people who commute into Copenhagen, but most people work locally. Visiting Svendholm was particularly important to me because Svendholm has been an important part of my narrative for a long time. Right? I used to give tours of Acorn on the regular, and I still do a lot of public speaking for the communes and such. And whenever I would do a tour of Acorn, or when I could do a public presentation about the FEC, I would say, oh, okay, here we are at Acorn, at whatever we were at the time, 10, 20, 30 people. And we use consensus, and at Twin Oaks, where they're like 90 to 100 people, they use this consensus-inspired bureaucratic democracy. And people would say, oh, well, that makes total sense, because you're so small, so you use consensus, and they're so big, so they can't use consensus. And it's like, well, no, actually, Twin Oaks has been using this wacky system since they were 15 people. Right? It's just a cultural difference. And at the same time, I mean, this idea that consensus is only possible with a small, intimate group of people, like intimate and well-aligned group of people, is pervasive in the communities movement, in the left, like in anybody who's aware of consensus generally, it seems. And I, like, don't agree, personally. And we actually, like, I've been at Acorn for almost 10 years now, and I've been there since we were at a low of, like, 7 people, and now we're at a max of 30 people, and every couple of years we'll have a conversation about whether or not and how much Acorn should grow. What is the ideal size for Acorn? And every time that we have the conversation, opinion is split roughly the same, where there's a couple of people who think that we're too big and we should actually shrink by a couple of people. There's a couple of people, like myself, who are into the idea of infinite growth, right? And then the majority of people fall in the middle and say, oh, I kind of like the size that we are, maybe another 5 people, because I'm afraid that if we grew beyond our population plus 5, important parts of our culture would no longer work, particularly consensus, right? It's like, okay, and so usually we come to that conclusion, we're like, okay, we'll grow by another 5 people. We grow by another 5 people, we have the conversation again, it's exactly the same, right? And we've kept growing, and now we're at 30 people, right? And so far, consensus hasn't broken down. And so Svendholm is important to me because I'd heard about Svendholm, a community of 80 adults in Denmark that has been operating by consensus, right? I was like, Acorn's nowhere near big for consensus if 80 people is working. Totally fine. And so I wanted to go there myself and talk to them and try to figure out what sort of exotic and unusual things they're doing in order to make the consensus process work at such a huge size as 80 people, right? So the other little fun thing about Svendholm, which is less relevant to me because I don't have a huge interest in children, is that there are 80 adults and 60 children. Which informs a lot of things about their structure. Like, they've got a lot of playgrounds all over the place, for one thing. Indoor and outdoor playgrounds. They actually have their own kindergarten there on an elementary school there on the property, because it's actually illegal to homeschool your kids in Denmark. But they had enough kids that they could get an official elementary school built on the property, and now several of them are paid employees of the state teaching their kids. Yeah. And they also, during their meetings, they set aside a little portion of time in every meeting for the kids to come in and bring something to the meeting, some proposal or some performance or something. So it's adorable, you know. So anyway, so I got there, right? I got a little tour, and I looked at the place, and it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they bought this old noble's estate in Denmark. This massive old, hundreds and hundreds of year old mansion, and all these stables that they've converted into community buildings, lots of residences and giant dining hall and the most beautiful kitchen you'll ever see in your life. And so I got the tour, and then I asked, okay, like, this is super important to my story. I've been really curious, how is it that you make consensus work with 80 people? It's such a huge number of people. And my host sort of looked at me completely nonplussed and was like, I don't know. We get together once a week and we sit in a room and we talk and we come to consensus. You know? I was like, oh, okay. But it's so many people, you know, like, how do you, it's not so hard. we're probably about as big as we could get. If we got another five people, we'd probably all fall apart. Right? You know. So, you know, I dug a little deeper, and there are a few interesting things that they do. You know, Acorn's process at 30 people is super casual, right? We have an agenda that people can write on. We have a facilitator, but we don't have a lot of different roles. We have, like, a facilitator and a note taker. We have a taskatron, somebody who writes down every time that somebody says that they'll do something. They write it down on the list, and then we read it at every meeting to remind them that they said that they would do it. But other than that, you know, you can put something on the agenda as soon as 24 hours in advance of the meeting. You don't actually have what it is. You just write a few words on it and put your name next to it. You know, it's like super casual, and we make it work. So with them, with 80 people, either because culturally they're more organized than we are or in order to make it work with that many people, they do a lot more written stuff. They post proposals in advance for people to read. When they get there to the meeting, they actually spend a relatively small amount of time discussing it. Right, and they discuss it, and if it doesn't seem like it's moving quickly towards consensus, then they take a representative sample of opinions in the room, and they put those people into a committee, and they send them out of the meeting to work on the proposal over the intervening week until the next meeting, with the assumption that if that representative sample of people can come to a compromise that's amenable to everybody, that it'll then pass the community easily. My understanding is they just sort of keep doing this, bringing it up to the meeting and integrating people with different opinions, until they can easily come to consensus. The other interesting thing, well, let's see. So the other two innovations, or the two particular innovations that I saw there, because the posting things and making committees is pretty, it's pretty standard, even though Acorn doesn't do it. One is that a few years ago, they realized that a lot of the proposals that were coming to the meetings were essentially foregone conclusions, right? It was like super easy decisions. You could just look at it and be like, oh, of course, this is what we're going to decide. But it needs to come to the meeting because of something, because really people need to be informed about it. They need to be given a chance to object. It's above a certain amount of money, whatever it is that determines that it must come to the community. But so what they did a few years ago is they realized there are a bunch of these coming to the meetings, and so they formed a small board of people, right, about five people on rotating two-year terms, and this board of people looks at the agenda every week, and they pull off everything that they think is easy, and they just make a decision about it. And they post those decisions, right, and they post them for a week, and if nobody objects for a week, then it's policy. And if somebody objects, then it goes to the meeting.
Sort of like a consent agenda.
Right. Yeah. I'm not familiar with this. No.
It's kind of like that. It's like, if it seems non-controversial, you scream test it. You just assume it, and if nobody screams within a certain period of time, you call it good. You don't have to actually discuss it. Yeah.
I like that. Except with a committee. It's a screaming committee.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And the other thing that they do, and this is my friend Ira, who has visited Svenholm before and hung out with him a bit, says that this might be due to Danish culture of being incredibly conflict avoidant. But so they have a membership process, right? And because they're consensus run, everybody has to agree, you know, for anybody to become a member. And it has to come to the meeting. But they've got a membership committee that is in charge of shepherding the process and bringing the visitors and applicants through the process and whatnot, which most communities do. But the membership committee has an extra responsibility here, and the responsibility of the membership committee is actually to make sure that no application gets to the meeting unless it is an obvious and unanimous yes. Right? So if there are any objections or concerns, the person's application just continues to simmer under the surface and the team quietly works behind the scenes in order to address the concerns, and it doesn't actually come to the meeting until everybody can stand up and say, yay, we love you, yes, come and live with us, because they think it would be totally awkward to bring it to the meeting and have somebody say, oh no, I'm actually concerned and I want to work this out.
Interesting.
But they still want to be able to say, yay, we love you, come and live with us. So they make sure that it does eventually come to the meeting. So the other interesting thing is that Acorn, amongst the Kekkinkade communities, Acorn distinguishes itself as well in having a mandatory group interpersonal process, right? The commune considers it its business to work on the interpersonal relationships of the members and make sure that people are getting along. And there's also expectations of members about how you treat each other and enter into conflict and try to exit out of conflict and that sort of thing. And although the other communities, at least Twin Oaks, have teams of people that will work on interpersonal processes, there's no community mandate in the same way. And there's no mandatory group interpersonal process. You can just say, if two Twin Oakers are having a problem with each other and one of them doesn't want to deal with it, they can say, fuck you, I'm not dealing with it, and nothing happens, right? And at Acorn, we see this mandatory group interpersonal process that we have as being, if not essential, incredibly helpful to our ability to actually run a consensus process and run the community in the way that we do, because it helps people deepen their relationships, resolve conflict in a relatively timely way so that it doesn't then boil out into the consensus process. And so I asked Svenholm what they did, and Svenholm actually has absolutely no mandatory group interpersonal process. And they have a interpersonal situation that's more similar to Twin Oaks, right? Where mostly everybody gets along, but there's a few people who really hate each other. And there's a couple of people who are completely disaffected from the political process. And yet, consensus works just fine. Which is interesting. So then I got into their economy, right? So their economy is, they also have a dual economy, like the Kekkonkaid communes. And they actually used to, when they started, and for many years, they're, I think, 35 years old at this point, they used to have an economy very, very similar to Twin Oaks' economy, right? With the labor hour requirement, but also something you don't necessarily know, which is that the Kekkonkaid communes don't have, they don't have, like, full-time jobs. They have a whole collection of tiny jobs, and people will sign up. And generally speaking, people have a hugely diverse work scene, right? They'll work many different hours, different days. They'll work in a bunch of different things. They'll have a huge basket of jobs. Some people do specialize, but for the most part, people have a basket of responsibilities. And so they had an economy like this, very similar to Twin Oaks, with a labor requirement, baskets of jobs, these sorts of things. They had a large internal businesses they ran, and members were fully supported by the commune. And actually, for many years, they were also important to me as an element of my storytelling, because not only do they cover all of your basic needs and also have a super beautiful place where they live, but they also have a vacation lottery where every couple of years, or more it's like a rota, a vacation rota, every couple of years your name comes up on the rota and the community hands you a couple $1,000 and gives you a year off or so, and you go off and explore the world. I was like, oh, that's totally sweet, because none of the Kekkonkaid communes do that, and it's in fact one of the bigger things that people will spend their personal time earning money for, to finance vacations. And so it's just like, the wonders that are possible, you know, in our glorious future. So I asked about the economy, and right now the economy is actually different than that. There's been two major changes that have occurred since the community was founded. So they started off with this very Twin Oaksian economy, but then some years ago they enacted a professionalization reform where they took all of the diverse jobs across the commune and they combined them into a smaller number of full-time positions, right? And I didn't actually explore this in depth, but I imagine that it was in part to allow people to develop professionally themselves, and in part to allow members to give sort of a higher quality of labor to the community as they were able to gain skills and experience in these particular areas. But everybody basically now applies for and fills some full-time position at the commune, or they work outside of the commune, which they had done before. There's a mixture of people working in the local community and people working at the commune. So that happened. And then about 10 years ago, an even more radical thing happened, right? 10 years ago, the community was shrinking slightly. It was aging. It was having trouble attracting people in their 30s. And the people who did join the commune in their 30s managed through a long, drawn-out, acrimonious process to convince the rest of the commune that income sharing was no longer cool amongst the young people in Denmark, and that if they continued in their income sharing ways, they just would not attract any more young people. And so they reformed the communal economy in a significantly more individualist direction. And they now have what they call the 80%, 20% system, where all of the full-time positions were assigned a salary by the commune. And now everybody who's a member of the commune turns over 80% of their income to the commune and keeps 20% as their private money, right? And when they did this, they also, in order to maintain some form of egalitarianism, instituted a floor below which your personal money could not sink. So if you made too little, then the community would subsidize your personal money up, and they instituted a ceiling above which your personal money could not rise, and you would just be taxed more in order to keep it low. And then several years later, the high earners managed to do away with the ceiling. And this was very controversial, and there's a number of people who are upset about it and who have been slowly leaving the community. But they've managed to continue, and it's interesting. There's been a number of changes that have come over the community since the reform, and it's a little hard to tease out the precise reason for them. Some of it is probably due to the individualist reform. Some of it is due to the economic crisis, which has hit Denmark and Europe and everywhere, and caused at least one of their businesses to fold. Their pallet and box-making business folded. Because they were no longer able to justify the labor expenses. Right? This is interesting in light of Twin Oaks, which has been running a hammocks business for decades, that is the only domestic hammocks manufacturer left, but they're making only $5 an hour. They continue to fund it because it's still making the money. Even though if they were paying outside people a standard wage, they probably would have gotten rid of the business ages ago. And I believe this is what happened to the pallet and box making business. They were like, well, in order to pay the amount of money to people that we need to pay them, it doesn't make sense to do this anymore. And so they folded it. But then another weird thing that has happened is that Danish society, so Svenholm is an egalitarian, income-sharing, democratic, non-violent, feminist, eco-groovy commune, right? But their mission when they were founded puts the emphasis on the eco-groovy, right? They were founded purposefully to push the envelope on sustainability. So they do a bunch of renewable energy stuff. They bought themselves a giant wind turbine for some large sum of money. They started up one of their businesses was this organic produce packaging business. It takes produce from the surrounding farms and packages it for grocery stores. And they're really like pushing the envelope here, and this is what they've promoted themselves to in Denmark. And in part, that might be because the income sharing, which provides this incredible social safety net and solidarity and equality amongst people, is somewhat redundant in Denmark, which has an incredibly effective welfare state. And the highest taxation level, or one of the highest taxation levels in the world, at like 50-some percent. And so now you look at the 80%, 20% system in Svenholm, and it's just like, well, it's like Denmark, except more so. Like, you pay even more in taxes, and you get even more in services, but it's already, like, the Danes are already sort of used to this. So the income sharing is not as amazing to them, because in the U.S., we're like, oh, income sharing, wow, you get your health covered, you know, you get, like, unemployment, you get maternity and paternity leave, you know, in Denmark, they're like, yeah, whatever. But so, and also in the U.S., the communes often define themselves in opposition to the political mainstream, right? Because we're doing something different, so we're defining ourselves somehow in opposition here. And with Svenholm, they're defining themselves ecologically in opposition to Danish society. And in the FEC, we're doing so much, we define ourselves often in opposition politically, because if you take the American political mainstream, or the American political spectrum, right? The FEC communes are way over here, you know, like way off the spectrum. But if you take the Danish political mainstream, apparently, according to people at Svenholm, Svenholm is like right here. Not even all the way on the far left of politics, right? And so what has happened recently is that in the last couple of years, right, they've been pushing the envelope ecologically and pushing and pushing and yelling and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, Danish society, like, woke up caught up and then surpassed them ecologically. And now, like, you see wind turbines all over the place, right? It's no longer weird to see one in Sonoma. And in fact, the organic produce packaging business folded because an even larger organic produce packaging business opened down the road and outcompeted them. You know. So these are the things going on that make it hard to determine what the effects on Svenholm have been of the individualist reform. Because what has been reported to me by the people that I talk to is that there's no longer the same esprit de corps in the community. There's sort of a loss of purpose in some ways. But there's also, these are things that are probably more associated with the 80%, 20% reform, is that there's also less that is being provided communally, right? So less and less is being provided communally, more and more is being put onto the 20% as to what it is that they're going to provide. And there's not as much energy going into the commune. In the early days, there'd be people on their sort of their own time outside of the labor requirement of the commune getting together and improving something, you know, fixing some old building or getting together to do some common project, or people would just like put in an extra amount of effort in order to improve the community, and it's not really happening anymore. There's a lot, sort of a turn towards individualism along with the turn towards the individualist economy. And one of the symptoms of this is that in the past so many years, the main thing that the building and maintenance crew has been doing is not opening up new areas to communal space or like repairing buildings. They've actually been mostly installing new kitchens and bathrooms and dividing the areas into single family houses. Yeah. And on top of that, they bought the property for a fair sum of money. I think 800 million Danish kroner, I want to say. Which works out to be about $40 million, I think, in current exchange rates. So they spent a chunk of change on the property, right? And then they doubled that debt in business investments and improvements to the community since then. So they're sitting on this huge debt, which they kept mentioning over and over again, because they're making payments on it, but currently the payments are 75% interest and only 25% principal. Right? So I kept asking them, so how long until you pay it off? And they're like, forever. So we'll never pay it off. So, I mean, another interesting thing is because of that debt, because of their failing businesses, because of the individualist economic reform, members' income earning potential is a major factor in membership decisions now. Yeah. And now, people apparently, you know, because they don't have a driving mission now, and they're not, in fact, significantly different than the rest of Denmark. In fact, a young mother who gave me a ride back to Copenhagen that I was talking to said that the maternity and paternity leave system inside of Svenholm is actually worse than the Danish system. The reason that people move there now is because they enjoy living socially, and it's a really great place to raise kids. But that's it. So that was Svenholm.